Michael Meets is a podcast interviewing regular people about life, work, their interests and aspirations. Coming up in this first podcast, Paul Hamilton talks about the things that have shaped his life from his grandparents' mixed marriage. For those of you who aren't living in the island of Ireland, that's when a Protestant marries a Catholic or vice versa. He also talks about being a husband, grandfather, employment mentor, former bodyguard to Gerry Adams and self-described boy soldier. Welcome to the first interview on michaelmeets.com. The year was 1956, the year that the Irish President unveiled a bus to Countess Markovic in St Stephen's Green. The Gaelic Athletic Association postponed the All-Ireland hurling and football finals due to an outbreak of polio, and Robert Briscoe became the first Jewish Lord Mayor of Dublin. It was also the year that the Irish Republican Army launched its border campaign in Northern Ireland with the bombing of a BBC relay transmitter. They burnt down the Macrofelt courthouse and bombed the British Army base in Enniskillen. On the other side of the Atlantic, Cuban revolutionaries including Fidel Castro landed in Cuba at the start of the Cuban Revolution, and Elvis had his first hit with Heartbreak Hotel. It was 11 years after the end of the First World War and the year that Paul Hamilton was born in the city of Belfast.
I grew up in the early 60s, then the world was beginning to change. The Beatles came along, Elvis was there. But politically, all over the world in the early 60s, you had the civil rights movement in America. The Berlin Wall went up. There was a lot of stuff going on generally within the world. All as I can remember is having a happy childhood. Played football. That was our life then growing up, was playing football. In Belfast at that time, I lived in a house. The house that I was had an inside toilet, which was a big thing. I lived in Navy, which is in the middle of the falls, and there's only two cars in the street. So I always would say that I came into a very, my mother and father worked, which was a big thing for Catholics in that time. I went to school taught by the Christian Brothers. They were very wicked, but I mean, if anything, they gave me my first taste of politicised Irish nationalism. The boys who I would have went to school with all lived down the falls, down in what would have been the old part of Belfast, the wee two up, two down houses, outside toilets, you know, very poverty stricken. When you look at photographs in the early 60s of all around Leeson Street and all, you could see the poverty. Whereas I came from the middle of the falls. We, as I say, had a garden, an inside toilet, a car. I actually remember having one of the first colour TVs in the street, and used to bring my mates in and charge them to watch a colour TV. Where I grew up, you knew that there was people called Protestants, but you never met them. Well, I would have met them maybe when I went into secondary school playing football. I played for Belfast Boys. Belfast Boys, which was a mixture of Catholics and Protestants, I'd have been about 13, because it was just before 69. We were taken over to Liverpool, trained in Liverpool's Anfield and at Goodison, and we played Liverpool Boys in Anfield. So that's a claim to fame that they, you know. So, but that would probably been the first time that you met Protestants. Mm-hmm. Playing football in the street was a no-no back in the late '60s, or playing handball against the gable walls. So if a peeler came, everybody run. So you had one policeman walking about terrorising the district. Actually, in our street, there was three policemen lived, and I remember one of them was called the Lallys, which were a big family. I think the dad was a peeler, three sons and a daughter a peeler. And one night, the door rapped, and Charlie Lally, I opened the door, and he had his old coat on, but he had his uniform underneath there, and says, "Paul, is your daddy in?" Right, he says, "Daddy, Charlie Lally for you." And I heard him saying, "John, I just noticed your text is out of date. You need to get your text done." And that was a neighbour. Like, so there was, even though they were Catholics, there was still that anti, you know, against the RUC as a child. Now, growing up anywhere in the world at that time is the police were, you know, obviously you didn't get on with them, the authority.
We all love to hear stories about our grandparents. Paul's grandparents came from different sides of the political spectrum.
My grandfather fought in 1916. I then found out that my grandfather on my father's side was gassed at a Ypres in Belgium or France, was recovering in a hospital, the Curragh Military Hospital, and was sent into Dublin in Easter 1916. My grandfather on my mother's side went down to Dublin to fight. So, and I would tell this story to people when I would have been doing the tours, is that I have this thing that one grandfather was firing out of a building, the other one was firing in, and if any of them had it connected, I wouldn't be sitting here today. If my granda, say, had I married a Protestant, I could have been born in Sandy Row.
Yeah.
So that's the thin line that is my world. I remember at the funeral, my grandfather's brothers wouldn't go into the house because there was a priest there, wouldn't go into St. Paul's Chapel, or wouldn't go into Milltown where he was buried. I didn't understand it at the time, but I realised that if you're an Orange man, you're not allowed into concreted ground, or consecrated ground as we used to call it, concreted ground. He died, and I remember going into the house, and I'm lying on the bed, stretched out, and in a shroud. And 2 weeks later, I'm lying in that bed. I was sent over to live with my granny. And like, you know, this strange thing that the last time I seen his bed, there was a dead man on it, you know. So my granny sort of started to rear me. And then due to things happening within their family, my uncle Eamon married and moved into the house in Irish Drive. My granny moved in. And what I can remember, my granny was an unpaid servant.
Like my own granny, Paul's granny worked in one of Belfast's linen mills. At the height of linen production, Belfast had 28 mills, with 8 of those in the Falls Road area. Again, like my own granny, Paul's granny worked in the mills while attending school part-time.
My granny was what was called a half-timer. She would have so many days in school and so many days in the linen mills. And I remember telling me stories about work, because the flax had to be kept wet, as she had been in her knees, up to her knees in water. But then my ma went in and was a stitcher, and I would have remembered, I went to St Finian's, which was at the top of Leeson Street, and she worked in Conway Mill for the Academy Shirt Factory, and you'd have went down on a, you know, in the good days. They always say that, you know, the summers were always better than them days. Now, you can remember them. The summers, you know, were really great. But that was, you were a child and you had more time to spend. But I had walked down, and you'd walked into Conway Street. And Conway Street would have been just lined with women. Mostly always women, because the women mostly worked. Men, if they did work, would have been in construction, brickies, whatever. And they'd have been all sitting out, you know, having their lunches and smoking, and the scarves around their head. We had holidays every year. Now, it might have been down to Waterfoot.
Yeah.
It might have been down south to Salt Hill or Tramore. But I always remember as a child being put in the car and taken away. Whereas my friends who I went to school with probably were never out of Belfast in their life. The furthest they got was the zoo. So I did have what I would say would be a very good upbringing. There was always this undercurrent that there was something not right with the world that I lived in. 1969, 15th of August happened, and my world just, I was 13. My whole world changed.
In what way?
I didn't have I had a childhood. See your adolescence, you know, you had a bit of you're physically changing, but I didn't go to war. War came to me. I was 13, and all of a sudden there was, you were seeing it on what was happening in Derry, and you, every now and again you were hearing the odd gunshot. And I remember standing on the 15th of August, the night, standing at the top of Ivy Drive and watching the sky pure red and hearing the crackling, the gunfire. And every, you know, the adults, I was a child. Because okay, I know 13-year-olds now could buy and sell you, but I was a child. I mean, I had only found out that there was no fire Christmas. Now kids know that there's no Santa when they're about six. So, and I can remember standing and watching all these people with bags, pillowcases, pushing prams. And it was like a scene out of a Second World War. They had months of August, September 1969 with the biggest mass movement of people since the Second World War. And I can remember saying to some man, saying, what's happening, what's happening? And his exact words stick with me. He says, son, your life's over. Things will never be the same here. I wasn't politically, because politics was never talked about it in the house. And only later on did I find out why. As I say, 1969 happened. And as I say, when it's the image that I have of Conway Street and all the women sitting outside, the next image when I think of Conway Street is going into it, and it's recorded on the archives, houses burning, and I was on the back of a coal lorry, because a mate of mine, Harry Heskett, lived in Conway Street, and I remember going into the house was burning, trying to get as much furniture out as possible, and hearing the gunfire. By then, barricades had went up on every street, and it was to keep the RUC and the B specials out. And I remember one night, so it had been the 15th, 16th, 17th, and the armoured car coming up the road. And I was like, just a war picture, everybody hiding down. Not now, it wasn't a tank, it was a short land, but it was on wheels. And I was like, you know, you're hiding from a German Tiger tank and all this here. So my world then become, all of a sudden I went from a child to an adult. And when I look at what's happening in the world nowadays, and you see the boy soldiers in Africa, I realised then that I was a boy soldier. I became a boy soldier. So as I say, 69 happened, everything changed. I mean, you knew, then you started to ask questions, and of course, I couldn't ask it in the house. My mother wanted to tell me, but my father didn't, obviously from the different backgrounds. Then they had what we called the honeymoon period, where I remember British soldiers in the house, giving them tea and water, and them showing me their rifles and all. And I was like, oh, this is happy days, oh, guns, a real gun, you know, you'd only seen them on the TV. But then the honeymoon period changed. The honeymoon period was, we as Catholic nationalists seen the British Army coming in to defend us, to stop the Protestants coming down with the backings of the RUC to burn us out. So we seen the British Army as saviours, but the older Republicans knew what, they weren't here to save us, they were here to back up the Unionist government. Remember, the first ever Prime Minister of this part of Ireland said it was a Protestant government for a Protestant people. I had never experienced bigotry or sectarianism, because it wasn't like a black and white situation. I mean, Protestants look like me, talk like me, and supported the same football teams as me. It was probably only, and as I say, then you had 1970 and then a curfew. I was caught up in the curfew. I was for 3 days caught in a house. We were ratting. I mean, you started throwing stones, the tear gas. I got caught up 3 days stuck in a house down the falls. I mean, then, of course, I got a, I was more worried, not a, I wasn't worried about getting the Brits catching me and giving me a hiding. I knew my dad would, and he did. Because when I finally made it up the road, he battered me, so he did. He didn't want, you know, didn't want us. In hindsight, and as a father, I could understand that no mother or father wanted their child to be caught in up. But was they made it, must have known what was coming. They knew this wee place was going to explode and what was going to happen, because it had exploded over the years. And so you had 1970, the curfew, 71 internment, which was life-changing for me. By late 70, I had joined the Republican movement. I think the first ever thing I ever done, it was coming up to an Easter, and writing on the walls, remember, 1916. I didn't know, fucking know what 1916, sorry if I curse.
No.
Had a good idea what 1916 was, because I remember 1966, the 50th anniversary of it. Sort of, and then I started, and my granny then started to educate me politically. She was the wife of an IRA man. So she would have educated me. But behind, don't let your father know, don't let your father know. So 71 internment happened. By that time, all the older men, now, and you have to remember this, of the 300 or 400 men arrested, very few of them were IRA men. They might have had the same name as an IRA man, but we knew that the IRA was there because you'd have seen them, or you might have been asked to do something and then something happened and you knew you were part of it. So by then the older, and then people, then the war arresting older. When I say older, I was 15, I'm talking 17, 18 year olds who maybe were, had been in the Fianna with me and had moved. So then you got moved up, and I remember being in a room, and technically you weren't allowed to join the IRA. You joined the Fianna, which was like the young IRA. But you weren't allowed to join the IRA until you were at least 17. And I remember sitting in a room full of 15, 16-year-olds. Who's 17 here? And everybody put their hand in. So then that became my journey. Nationalist areas to the British Army, both in Belfast and Derry, mostly Belfast and Derry, were what called no-go areas. The IRA openly walked about with weapons patrolling the area. British soldiers, if they came in, it was to do a quick raid and out again. So then you had Operation Motorman, where literally, and I seen real tanks, an actual tank with a big gun on it coming up the Falls Road. And they came in, took over schools. Actually, the school that I was in, St. Peter's, it took over part of it, took over Casement Park, just literally any big areas where they could, and put them. So then you had the confrontation where me as a, by then 16, stand toe-to-toe with an 18-year-old fella from England. But the only difference was I had no gun. Well, I had, but I hadn't, he had a gun, armoured jacket and all that there. And you were going toe-to-toe for digs with him. Well, I left school at 15 with an O level in writing. And no way I said to you that the first year I was top of my class. Yeah. Education became a non-entity during the rest of the years, because you'd have been sitting in the class and the door opened, rat, and everybody would have run out. So the education system just, we weren't interested in education. We were interested in what's happening outside.
So Northern Ireland erupts and you leave school with what you believe is nothing better than a no level in writing. What do you do for work?
My first job was a van boy in Cuse's Bakery, which was a local bakery. And I left school at 15 and it lasted 6 months because they brought a law in that nobody could work on a, you know, like a, as a van boy until they were 16. So I then went to work as a message boy, as they called them. It was where you had a bike, and it was for a local record company, and it was going around all the record shops. So you had a wee bike with a basket on it, driving about. But I remember going for jobs and being told, because I was a Catholic. I mean, you were literally told. You would have seen it in shop doors. No Catholic need apply. The local paper, the local evening paper, which I wouldn't even, if he give me it free, the Belfast Telegraph carried articles, no Catholics need apply. So then a job came up, and because the co-op would have been seen as a very Protestant organisation, they advertised for Catholics, young Catholic men, to go as butchers. Went down, done an exam. I think it was just a simple, I think they wanted to see what your level of your education was. So I got offered a job, and I remember my first wage, £11, which was, wow, massive then. Mm-hmm. So I started off as an apprentice butcher, and I remember you had my first day, I had to go up to Federation Street on the Ravenhill Road, which would be in a very, would have been a Protestant area, and getting on the bus and all these. Now, by then I would have been left school, but all these wee schoolboys going to Orangefield and all the different Protestant schools. I got off at Federation. I asked the busman to let me off at Federation Street. So I always remember starting and all these ones making remarks about it. These are all the wee Fenians, you know. And you a Fenian? Where do you live and all? Because that was the whole idea, get more Catholics to work. And I remember, when you think of yourself at 30, or when you think of yourself at 40, now, I still think I'm nearly 60, but I would say a man in his 30s said to me, "Son, keep your head down, don't be rocking the boat here." He was a Catholic, and that was the old attitude, don't rock the boat, you know, just be grateful you have a job. So lunchtime came, and we were brought up to the canteen. And for the first time in my life, I never seen as big. And the canteen was a photograph. Now, when I say a photograph, the canteen was massive. The full length of the wall, the Queen on one side, the Duke on the other side, and a massive, the biggest Union Jack I've ever seen in my life. And that was it. So a couple of weeks there, just to be trained up, just to, you know, get you the basics of it. I actually seen a fella losing his arm. They had a big mincer, a massive big mincer for making the mince for all the different shops. And this guy was plunging and plunging. And whatever he plunged, went down, lost his arm up to his elbow. So he did, just minced. So after a week or two in the Federation Street, you were then sent out to different butchers. The co-op, they used to have either a butcher's and the grocery department separate or amalgamated as one. But by then, the IRA were targeting any co-op shops. There was about five in West Belfast. So the IRA went in and bombed them. So that meant any co-ops that I maybe worked at during the week in the factory, and then maybe Friday and Saturday, you went to the shop. So all the shops that I was going to was all Protestant. But with my name, Hamilton, I could sort of get away with it. I knew that I had an Uncle Charlie. So he became my granddad. And he was well known. He was a top man in Belfast City Council. "Who are you, Hamilton's from Sandy Row? Who's your granddad?" "Charlie." "Oh, right, I know them ones." But there's one shop I went into, and it was Donegal Pass, and your woman says to me, "Are you Hamilton? You're the Fenian one." And she left, and the butcher turned around and says, "Get out of here, quick." So I got out, and then I wasn't allowed back into Donegal Pass. So I know that she must have went out and told somebody, and they were coming in. I was working on the co-op, the top of that Breda, and the UDA had blocked the road. And in comes this He was full military uniform with his two buddies. He was a top man in the UDA. I forget his name, up there. And his wife worked in there. She brought him in and introduced him to me. That's wee Paul, the wee Fenian. And he went, right, he says, son, I think it'd be better that you leave here. Nah. So that's two brushes. I mean, there was plenty of young lads of my age were being found in quarries, and beat to death, shot to death, whatever. So I then went for a job in, there was a job advertised in Stewart's on Lisburn Road, and I went. Your man says, listen, when can you start? I just started right away. I was doing a wee bit of the double in the abattoir, a couple of mornings a week. He was getting me a few bob. Right, Hamilton, where do you live? AV Drive. Where's that? Well, I had been then learned to be cocky enough to say Broadway. Broadway was the Protestant end, would have been maybe, say, five, six streets away. So, all right, okay, right, no problem. Right, I just need a few details. What school did you go to? No, he asked me to fill it in, and I put St. Finian's Primary, St. Peter's Secondary. Right, right, okay. And you filled in the rest of it. Next thing, he looked at it, and he went, all right, well, Paul Ivanor, he wanted to know when I could start, right? We'll just get the application form done. And he went, right, okay. Listen, I've still one or two more to see. I've got your phone number, and we'll arrange whatever. So I walked, and I walked it from the Lisburn Road, and you had to be careful because you had the village, but it would have been, say, a time of day when there wouldn't have been too many people about. So I, by the time I had walked from the Lisburn Road to Avey, I walked down and my man says to me, listen, some fella's called whatever was on the phone. He says, listen, he's got somebody wee bit more experienced than you. He hadn't the guts to tell me that I didn't get the job because it was a Catholic.
Paul worked in a number of jobs, but mainly as a butcher until his life took an unexpected turn.
Late October 1977, I was charged with attempted murder of a British Army major during the, it was a Queen's Silver Jubilee, and she had come to here, and things had just went crazy. I was arrested October. I had been on the run, as they called it. I came up to, I was going with a girl at the time, and I just went to the wrong house the wrong night, and the house got hit. One of the RUC men, the branch man, standing on a chair, and I was standing on the wall, and he just constantly just hit me in the head. And he said to me, you know, you'll have nightmares about me. And I still do. So he did, with a just, I know guys brought in the crumb that the screws even refused to take because they were in that bad a state, but because of the beatings that they got. But it went to court. The only evidence against you was your own statement. There was no, yes, in some cases people were caught red-handed or they had other forensic evidence, but 90% of the people who ended up in the H blocks signed their own, signed a statement. I got sentenced to 100 years with all the different charges, and I remember going, I'd be 119 when I get out. But I actually got 12 years was the initial. That was for attempted murder. While I was in jail, I got married. The girlfriend was pregnant, and so we got married in jail. I was married in the gym. It was then the gymnasium in the Crum. We went back to the governor's office, and funny enough, on the first time I went up as when they opened the Crum, and your mom was given the tour, and he says, and this is the governor's office, and I says, no, it's not. And there was a crowd there, and it was out of me before. And he says, well, take it you either worked here or you were a guest. I says, well, I wouldn't say it was a guest, it was a hotel. I says, no, that was the assistant governor's office. The governor's office is, see where them toilets are? They've converted it all. He says, oh, I take it you were up in front of them. I says, aye, but I also, that's where my wedding reception was. And I have since remarried, and he looked at my wife and he says, yeah? He says, no, no. But they allowed a wedding cake in. See, but when I got it in, it was just battered. You know, you couldn't even cut it. So it was. So you had like a tea and biscuits and the cake, and then I had 5 minutes with a screw stand at the door with my late wife.
On his release from jail in 1983, Paul continued as an active member of his community and got more involved politically with Sinn Féin. But in 1992, he was asked to take on a new role within the party that resulted in him being in the public eye.
1992, I was asked, would I be Gerry Adams's his security driver stroke bodyguard? Mm-hmm. So I then went from becoming a military soldier to a political, because I have to say he politicised me more in the sense, you know. And I have to say, the years between 1992 and 2000, up to the referendum, were probably one of the most interesting years. I mean, where he went, I went.
Gerry Adams?
Yeah. Yes, we had our rough days and sleeping on sofas, but that went from sleeping on sofas to sleeping in 5-star hotels, you know.
Can I ask who you met?
Clinton, Mandela, half of Hollywood, Irish American Hollywood, you know, anybody that, I mean, he came into contact. Now, sometimes, when I say I met Clinton, I literally, when he came here to Belfast, it was literally, you know, a handshake with him, you know, in the City Hall.
When Paul took on the role as security for Gerry Adams, he didn't anticipate the future impact it would have on his life.
It's come back to bite me in the bum, because, I mean, people made allegations against me. So because he was in the public domain, I was in the, you know, if Gerry Adams was there, I was beside him or in front of him or behind him or something. So, and there has been this campaign to discredit him. But they try to discredit him and the people around him. And I mean, there was allegations about me. I mean, I had one night to literally sit down and say to my daughter that she phoned me to say the rumour going about the road that me and two other non-Republicans were whisked away to England because we had been working for MI5. Mm. And I had to go public. I'd actually go on the next day on the Irish News and say, I'm still here in Belfast. But I actually asked somebody, why are they doing this on me? Says Paul, to get at Gerry Adams. They need to target all the, you know, throw enough mud around the people around him that'll sort of stick on him. So, I mean, my past, I mean, a lot of people did what they did and that's it. But thank God, I mean, it's been a while, quite a while. I mean, I've had injunctions against papers, injunctions against programmes, to stop them. I mean, one paper in particular, I have an injunction against them saying my name or printing a photograph of me, but the innuendo's there.
When you talk to Paul, he tells you about the many twists and turns that his life has taken. And in 2005, you've guessed it, another turn.
Well, what I went through, and then all of a sudden, in 2005, the IRA said the war was over. But from the year 2000 to the year 2005, I was sort of trying. By then, my marriage was falling apart. And I was trying to just, I didn't know what I was doing. Mm. I know now, my post-traumatic stress was kicking in. 2005, I found myself out of a job, a real job, and have to make a life for myself. My marriage broke up. Found myself living on my own. Not doing very well. Not coping. And lucky enough, somebody gave me a kick in the arse. And he rapped my door and he says, listen, you need help. And he gave me help. Sent me for help.
That kick in the arse helped Paul back to education. And he started studying for a diploma in counselling.
Your journey's from the day you're born. But every night, it's like a car journey and you're sitting and it fucks up and you take a wrong turning. Mine was always, I was always going a different way, you know. And And they had started to... And the first person you counselled yourself.
Yeah.
So I started it. I was really enjoying it. And a couple of setbacks in the sense... I was at a funeral one day and somebody said to me, well, what are you doing with yourself? I haven't seen you about. Because I'd withdrawn. Because by then, a lot of the old shit was coming out. So I took the... And then living on my own. I was sort of way just not mixing. Wouldn't go to do's or anything, you know. Just felt that I needed to put it all behind. I didn't want to be in it.
Mm.
I'd give my life till it. But I was on a different journey and I needed the... So... And this fella said to me, what are you doing with yourself? I says, I'm training to be a counsellor. Oh, fuck, are we going to have to vote for you? I says, no. Not that type of counsellor. Like a counsellor that, you know, people with mental health. You fucking joking. You couldn't counsel anybody. You beat the crap out of them. And I actually came away thinking... And I brought it up the next class and they said, no, you don't want that self-doubt. You want to be a counsellor, don't let... So, a proud day for me, you asked me about proud days, was when my daughter graduated, my eldest daughter. But a really proud day for me was when I graduated with my diploma. I mean, if you had walked into my house late 2005, all there was photographs of me all over on my past life and memory cards of dead people who had died during the conflict. Now there's photographs of my grandchildren and the pride of place is my diploma for counselling.
An impromptu invite to a surprise birthday party, life decided to deal Paul a new deck.
One of my tutors was Dipna. My other tutor come in and says, Paul, there's a surprise party for Dipna. She's 40 and we're having it in St. Paul's. I normally done a Saturday morning, but I wasn't working, so here's my happy day as I'll go to that. But I had not been, if I was out, it was down to the local man's bar, you know, I hadn't had no contact. I was living like a hermit. And the next thing was Dipna introduced me to her sister. And her claim to fame is not only did she get me a diploma in counselling, she got me a wife. So I married Rosie, her sister, 5 years ago. So then my life started to change. I was educated. I'd found me a partner. I could see, you know... Part of me when the war ended was I couldn't see a future. This is my life.
Mm.
I was only used to doing. But then part of me seeing that I had a future, a chance to change.
Paul takes groups and tours of West Belfast, now a mecca for tourists who visit the city and who are interested in the Troubles. One of those tours was slightly different than all the others.
So I had a tour that day with 40 young people from Armagh. Well, there was two of us doing a tour, 20 each. They were coming up to do the political tour, West Belfast. So I arrived in the suit and I said to the teacher, listen, I normally switch my phone off, but I've been told, I'm only after doing an interview for a job, and I've been told I should hear by within the hour. So we start off at Divis Flats and you go through the history and then we stand at the International Wall where all the murals was and the phone call and I knew it was here. And I says, hello. Says, hello, this is Maria from Job Assist. How you doing? I says, unfortunately, you got the job and we're going to have the... Well, I let out a yell. The kids all... He says, who's... I says, 20 kids from Armagh City who are doing a tour with me. So that was it. And I mean, I got the job and my life changed completely. It had been changing, Michael, but it totally changed the sense, whereas I scrimped and scraped. If I couldn't get it, and obviously with my background, I mean, I tried to go back to work for get a couple of bob because I'd away from kids, and I was working in a shop at the top of Donegal Road, and I was told that the loyalists were spotted in it. So I said to him, man, listen, I'm just advising you, 2 weeks later they went in to shoot me and I wasn't there, but they shot the owner, but he survived it, lucky enough. So it's not everybody would have took me on and work, you know. I work in here, I help people get jobs, but I also, we have a Still in Prison project, which we work with ex-prisoners. And I sit in this room and many other rooms all over West Belfast and say to people, I've seen men sitting there, grown men, who big tough IRA men sitting crying because they know they need help and they didn't know where to turn. And I says, well, here's my story. And I tell them my story. And I'll say, I'm not saying what you're going through is what I went through, but it's something similar. So I'd like to think now I'm making a difference both to this community, helping them. I know we're under pressure with the funding and whatever, but I'm hoping that this community will benefit for what I can put into it. Give back. I mean, yes, as I said at the start, I didn't go to a war. War came to me. Now we're trying to rebuild this. And I do an awful lot of... Well, it has died away lately because of the flag, but I would have done an awful lot of work cross-community, working with Loyalist ex-prisoners, and one of them actually said to me one day, why do you do this for us? I says, well, I mean, if you can't make friends with your enemy, who can you make friends with?
And there we have it, an insight into the life of Paul Hamilton. But before we finished up, I asked him one last question. I asked Paul, if in 60 years' time his great-great-grandchildren are listening to this, what would he like to say to them?
What I did for them. So did. There's been a lot of hurt and a lot of stuff. I've had to do stuff, watch, see stuff. But when people ask me, was it worth it? It was, because my children, and I've 10 grandchildren, will not have to do what we had to do, will not have to suffer what we had to suffer. And it's just, it was to make it a better place for them. Bobby Sands said, let our revenge be the laughter of our children. And that's, see, when my kids can go for a job and get a job because of their qualifications and not be turned away because of who they are or what. Though, as an ex-prisoner, my children do, I mean, one of my sons is a security man and he went for a job in G4 and they wouldn't give him it. Not so much because of me, but because of his mother was had robbed a bank for the IRA. I mean, she was an ex-prisoner too. So there is still that barriers which we're trying to break down. I'm not allowed the have house insurance, I'm not allowed, there's a lot of things as an act, I'm not allowed back into America, I'm not allowed into Australia, but there's a lot of stuff that I'm not allowed because of my time as an ex-prisoner. We're trying to break them barriers down. So I mean, hopefully by, if in 60 years time my great grandchildren are listening to this, they'll know if they are in a better place. And they'll know that it was because of what the men and women of my generation did for them.
Many thanks to everyone who encouraged me to jump in with 2 feet and start this podcast. 3 years in the making. Thanks to Veronica Brown for suggesting Paul as a good person to chat to. Thanks to Job Assist, who kindly allowed me to use their offices for recording. And most importantly, thanks to Paul for giving up his time and for being so open and sharing his life journey. Interested in hearing about future interviews on michaelmeads.com? Go over to the website, michaelmeads.com, and register for the newsletter or subscribe via iTunes, SoundCloud, or Audioboo. Thanks for listening. Your feedback and comments and questions are welcome by emailing hello@michaelmeads.com or by joining the conversation on Facebook, facebook.com/michaelmeads.